Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI. So today we're diving deep into, well, a truly massive work of Victorian literature. It's this glittering but also quite ruthless world.
Mm-hmm.
We're focusing on a novel that famously declares itself without a hero. It's more like this sweeping critique of high society.
William Makepeace Thackeray's Vanity Fair, it's a giant.
It really is. And Thackeray himself, living 1811 to 1863, he always gets mentioned alongside Dickens, right? Twin pillars of the era.
They do, but their styles are just so different. Dickens, you know, he had those passionate calls for social reform.
Mm-hmm.
Thackeray, he gives us this biting psychological realism.
Yeah, much more cynical, maybe kind of detached satire.
Exactly. It feels like he's less interested in fixing society's problems and more in just mapping them out with incredible precision.
And you really get the sense that cynicism was personal for him. He came from wealth, but then experienced pretty devastating financial ruin himself.
Right. And that background seems to have, well, fueled his obsession with class, status, the sheer power of money. You see it all through Vanity Fair.
Which makes the novel, published serially back in 1847-48, feel so incredibly potent even now.
And the title itself, Vanity Fair.
Yeah.
That's your first clue, isn't it?
Definitely. It's an allusion, right, to Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
Yeah, exactly. Bunyan's Vanity Fair was this sort of permanent, corrupt market town full of worldly temptations. But I think the subtitle Thackeray adds is what really grabs you.
A novel without a hero.
That's the one. It's like a manifesto.
It totally is. He's not just telling a story. He's deliberately messing with the whole novel form. He refuses to give you that morally perfect main character.
Which forces you, the reader, to navigate this really complex world where pretty much everyone is morally compromised in some way.
So our mission today, I guess, is to unpack that ambiguity, try and understand what makes these flawed people just so memorable.
Okay, so where does it all kick off? Right at the gates of Miss Pinkerton's Academy for Young Ladies.
Right. Two young women are leaving school. Friends, apparently, but total opposites in background and personality.
Poised to enter, you know, the social battlefield of Regency England.
Yeah.
And the contrast between them is immediate and stark.
First, you have Amelia Sedley. She's the gentle one, comes from a wealthy family. Everyone adores her. Very sentimental.
Mm. Almost painfully so.
Mm.
And quite passive, really.
She kind of embodies that conventional idea of goodness. But in this world, in Vanity Fair, that goodness starts to look like a liability, almost a fatal flaw.
And then there's Rebecca Sharp.
Becky, the star, really.
Absolutely. An orphan, penniless, but incredibly smart, witty, charming.
And fiercely ambitious. Utterly ruthless.
She has nothing except her wits. So she looks at society and basically sees it as this system to be gamed, to be exploited for survival.
So when you set up those two foils, Amelia and Becky, the central question of the novel just jumps out, doesn't it?
Yeah. In this corrupt world, as Vanity Fair, does Amelia's kind of passive goodness just lead to suffering?
Or is Becky's cunning, her ruthless ambition, the only way to actually get ahead, to survive?
It's why Becky is just endlessly fascinating. She is a survivor, through and through. You see it right away.
Like her first attempt trying to snag Amelia's brother, Joss Sedley, the rich, foolish one?
Right. Fails spectacularly. But does she give up? No. She pivots immediately.
Yeah.
Takes a job as a governess for the Crawleys.
The eccentric Crawley family. And she instantly starts working the angles there.
She's always playing the long game, using her charm, her wit, like currency.
Then there's the secret marriage to Rawdon Crawley. She's hoping to inherit old Miss Crawley's fortune.
And it backfires completely. They both get disinherited. Huge setback.
But even that doesn't stop her. They move to London.
And somehow manage to live this incredibly glamorous, fashionable life. On what? Basically credit, charm, and Rawdon's winnings from gambling.
Her social climbing is just astonishing. It reaches its peak with her association with the Marquess of Steyne. Very powerful, very dangerous man.
And it's around this time she delivers that famous line, the one that sums up so much about her and maybe the book's philosophy.
I think I could be a good woman if I had 5,000 a year.
Exactly. It's cynical, but is it maybe true in this world?
Well, if you connect it back to Thackeray's own life, that fear of poverty, it suggests morality isn't inherent. It's a luxury.
Something only the wealthy can afford without constantly struggling just to exist.
Yeah. Thackeray seems to imply that Becky's open scheming, though maybe awful, is possibly more honest than the hidden greed of the aristocracy who pretend otherwise.
They're all playing the same game. She's just open about it.
Okay, so let's contrast Becky's constant maneuvering with Amelia. What's Amelia's big flaw? It's not malice.
No, not at all. It's more like the vanity of sentimentality.
Yeah.
She just clings obsessively to this idealized image of her fiancé, George Osborne.
Even after he's dead, she sacrifices her entire present for this comforting but ultimately false memory of the past.
And that obsession directly impacts William Dobbin.
Ah, Dobbin. The closest thing to a moral center in the whole book, you could argue.
Maybe. But even he's flawed, right? His vanity is this sort of selfless suffering. His entire life revolves around his unrequited love for Amelia.
He's incredibly loyal, patient to a fault, but also kind of passive, socially awkward. He even helps George marry Amelia.
It's maddening. Is his patience a virtue, or is it just another kind of obsession, like a martyrdom complex that stops him living his own life? It's hard to say.
You don't quite know whether to admire him or feel incredibly frustrated by him.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Rawdon Crawley, Becky's husband. He starts off as this sort of dissolute army guy, gambler.
Yeah, not very promising, but he has this surprising redemption arc.
He does. It comes through his love for his son, little Rawdon. That devotion is completely genuine, totally selfless.
It really humanizes him, makes him one of the most sympathetic characters by the end, despite everything.
So the plot starts to really pick up speed and fracture when Amelia's father, Mr. Sedley, loses all his money.
Big turning point. Shows how fragile fortunes are in this world.
Absolutely. And it forces George Osborne's incredibly snobby father to order George to break off the engagement with Amelia now that she's poor.
But George, kind of surprisingly, may be persuaded by Dobbin.
Definitely persuaded by Dobbin.
He defies his father, marries Amelia anyway, and gets instantly cut off, disinherited.
Which sets the scene for the massive central climax, the Battle of Waterloo.
All the characters end up in Brussels just before the battle. It's depicted as this bizarre mix of high society parties and underlying panic.
Total whirlwind. And George, true to form, is flirting shamelessly with Becky right up until the end. Passes her that note.
Asking her to run away with him. The nerve.
And then bang, the battle happens. Thackeray presents it as this huge impersonal force that just shatters lives randomly.
George is killed the next day. Amelia is left pregnant, widowed, and completely broke.
And Becky. What's her reaction?
Yeah.
She's coolly selling her carriage horses at inflated prices to people fleeing the city. Pragmatism personified.
It's brutal. So after Waterloo, the middle years unfold. Becky and Rawdon have their glamorous but precarious climb in London society.
Financed by debt and gambling, reaching its peak with Lord Steyne's patronage.
While Amelia sinks into this quiet, genteel poverty, she only really survives because Dobbin, who's away in India, secretly sends money back via her brother Joss.
But Becky's ascent can't last.
Yeah.
The breaking point comes when Rawdon walks in on her and Lord Steyne.
He finds them together, finds evidence of money Steyne gave her that she hid. It's the ultimate betrayal for him.
Yeah, he assaults Steyne, then leaves Becky for good. Her reputation is just destroyed. She's cast out of society.
You feel for Rawdon there. His simple, perhaps naive loyalty couldn't survive Becky's ambition. He finally sees the reality of Vanity Fair.
The aftermath is drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
Rawdon goes into exile, eventually dies. Amelia, heartbroken and poor, gives up her son, Georgie, to his wealthy grandfather so he can have a better life.
Dobbin comes back from India, ready to finally be with Amelia.
Only to find she's still obsessed with the idealized ghost of George. It's just too much for him. He leaves again.
It seems hopeless for them. Until that final gathering, years later, in Germany at Pumpernickel.
And Becky performs one last incredible act. Its motivation is totally ambiguous. Is it kindness? Cruelty? Just self-interest?
Who knows with Becky? But she shows Amelia the note. The note George wrote right before Waterloo asking Becky to elope.
And that finally shatters Amelia's lifelong illusion about her perfect dead husband.
It frees her. She finally writes to Dobbin. They get married.
And find, as Thackeray puts it, a quiet, if not ecstatic, happiness. Which feels about right, doesn't it? Realistic.
Yeah, not exactly a fairy tale ending, but maybe a real one. And what about Becky?
Well, she attaches herself to Joss Sedley, Amelia's brother, who's now back from India, wealthy but ailing.
And then Joss dies rather mysteriously.
Mm-hmm. Conveniently, right after taking out a large life insurance policy with Becky as the beneficiary.
So Becky finally gets her financial security. Comfortable, maybe, but alone. The ultimate survivor, paying a certain price.
It really reinforces that idea that morality is flexible in Vanity Fair.
Okay, stepping back from the plot, let's talk themes. Vanity and hypocrisy are obviously central.
Relentlessly so. Everyone is driven by some kind of pride. Pride in money, status, family, even, like with Dobbin, pride in suffering.
And that point about Becky's honesty, her open ambition versus the veiled greed of the upper classes, keeps coming back.
Thackeray really seems to argue that the only difference is the facade. Becky doesn't bother with one.
Which links straight into illusion versus reality. That feels like the core message.
Absolutely. Amelia's fantasy, George, Dobbin's idealized Amelia, Becky's constant performance. The novel insists that maturity means shattering those illusions.
Facing the messy, disappointing reality of people.
And that lens really colors his view of love and marriage, too. He just demolishes sentimental notions of love.
Yeah, most relationships seem like transactions for status, security, money.
Even Dobbin's final victory in marrying Amelia feels melancholic. The prize he chased for decades had lost its shine by the time he got it.
Now we have to talk about the narrative style. The famous puppet master narrator.
Oh, yeah. Thackeray's voice is constantly breaking in. He's omniscient, addresses the reader directly, offers little philosophical comments, judges the characters.
He literally calls himself the manager of the performance, pulling the puppet's strings.
Which is a brilliant device, actually. It stops you from just passively consuming the story. It forces you to engage critically, to see it as a performance.
And the satire is just woven into everything. The irony starts with the title Affair. That's anything but fair.
He mocks everyone with this sharp wit. The aristocracy, the military, the newly rich, no one is spared.
There's some great symbolism, too, isn't there? Like Becky often being associated with the color green.
Mm-hmm. Green for envy, green for money, maybe even something serpentine, cunning. It really works.
So when you finish the book, what's the lasting feeling? For me, it's a kind of wry melancholy.
I agree. And Thackeray sums it up perfectly himself at the very end. Ah, vanitas vanitatum. Which of us is happy in this world? Which of us has his desire? Or having it is satisfied.
That line just lands so heavily. It makes the novel feel incredibly modern, doesn't it?
Totally. The desire for money, the fear of being irrelevant, our capacity for self-delusion. These are timeless human struggles.
I think the novel's real genius is how it refuses to give easy answers about morality. It reminds you that virtue isn't always rewarded.
And ambition, even ruthless ambition, often kind of works out.
Yeah.
At least materially.
It just forces us to look at all those uncomfortable shades of gray that make up real life. It really is an enduring mirror for our own times.
Absolutely. Still holds up.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.